From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the show, The Big Show. My name is Matt.
And I'm Ben, and that's our super producer, Noel, behind the boards or the keys.
Yeah, we're just going to point to him. He's right over there.
So if you have a very specific form of probably non-existent synesthesia, you can feel our fingers moving. And it probably, you know, feels the way lavender smells or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it feels very, very nice, I'm assuming.
So it's interesting that our segue or our banter at the top of this episode concerns sensation, right? Because that is one of the abiding universal characteristics of life. It's the ability to sense something, right, from your outside environment and then in some way to respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we think about what life actually is. Oh, and spoiler alert, I forgot, Matt, what's the name of this episode?
The Search for Extraterrestrial Life. So life not on planet Earth.
Yes, and also, you know, bonus points to us as a species if we find someone intelligent until
yes.
They wipe us out.
Yes.
So anyway, we're talking about this search for life somewhere out there in the darkness of space. And one thing that we have to do before we even address the idea of looking for life is define it, right? What exactly yeah. is this whole life shtick?
Well, life is it's the thing or the condition that separates, plants from inorganic material and animals from inorganic material. So kind of like what you said, Ben, the ability to sense the outside world, to take in stimuli. So that it also includes the ability to grow, the capacity for growth.
Okay, yeah.
And reproduction, you have to be able to make copies of yourself. You have to have some kind of functional activity, either whether that's movement mm-hmm. or, I don't know.
It's really slow rate of growth.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. And there's also one other thing. The continual change mm-hmm. until death. Although that's not necessarily true because
yeah.
we've seen some of the animals we've talked about and some of the immortality stuff.
Oh yeah, like Nutricula teratopsis.
Yes.
Isn't that the jellyfish that ages
yes.
and then turns into a child?
So essentially
again?
Just going through entropy.
Yeah. Okay, I see. I like the way you say that last part better, going through entropy. And we know there are different types of life. Well, there are different types of hypothetical
yes.
life. So we are carbon-based life forms. You listening to this right now, there's an overwhelming probability that you are also a carbon-based life form unless extraterrestrials or artificially intelligent programs have reached a level of which we are unaware.
Or unless we're all just holograms inside some huge matrix.
Right, yeah, inside the dream of some gigantic turtle.
And in that sense, the carbon and it's just bits of data.
Yeah. Just a firing synapse. So we know that there are theoretical forms of biology that could exist, other life forms. It's possible that carbon might not be the only creature in the game. Silicon-based life forms, ammonia, methane, hydrogen, fluoride, and so on, right? And this concept of non-carbon life does a very important thing. Theoretically, it opens the door, widens the spectrum for xenobiologists and sci-fi fans and so on to look at a wider range of possible homes for alien life, right?
Exactly. So now you can look yeah. at a planet that there isn't a lot of water on the planet.
Great.
There
yeah.
isn't a lot of carbon, but there might be a bunch of silica.
A bunch of ammonia.
There you go. There might be methane lakes, methane pools all over the planet. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's go check those out.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating thing. I want to go back to types of life toward the end of this for something that's complete speculation. But one thing that we learn in our continual search for extraterrestrial life is that we still have a lot to learn about terrestrial life. There's still a lot we don't know. Like, for instance, what is the most common life form?
Well, can I guess?
Yeah, guess for it, yeah.
I would guess some type of bacterium.
Yeah, I would have too. And it's interesting because there's a great article, I think it was in Smithsonian, that tells us that okay, here we go. It's my first mispronunciation of the episode. Pelagibacter ubique, which sounds sort of like some Eastern European shoe store.
Mm-hmm.
This single-celled organism is usually cited as the most common organism in the world. It's the statistically, if you were rolling the dice to become an organism, the odds are that you would become this one.
Wow, that's crazy to think about.
Yeah. But that might not be the case, because it turns out there's something that eats P. unique.
Okay, that is also widespread, just all over the place.
Yep.
Numerous.
Yep. It's a virus.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So here's the thing. This virus, P. unique, has four different viruses that parasitize it, or, you know, prey on it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those, which has the incredibly unmemorable name of HTV-CO10P, is the most common of those viruses.
Okay.
And so if we consider a virus to be a living thing, then it turns out that our boy HTV is the world's most common life form. But therein lies the debate, right?
Because yeah, is a virus alive? Is it, does it meet all of the different criteria? Well, it definitely meets the reproduction,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
It has functional activity, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how that is defined, but.
Yeah, functional activity is a little bit, I don't know, a little bit softball, right?
What about capacity for growth?
Well, it can change, it can.
Cause reproduction and growth is very different.
Yeah, if we differentiate those.
We'll have to talk to someone, Ben.
Well, because, the thing is that a virus, for people who don't think a virus counts as life, a virus has to use the metabolic process of its host in order to grow and reproduce.
There you go. Okay.
So a virus is inherently a parasite. So this means that they may not actually be life, or they're somewhere between life, you know?
Mm. Their third category.
Right. Yeah. And there's some weird, maybe there's some weird spectrum of life to not life. But okay. So we know that our world is teeming with life.
Yes.
It's everywhere.
Ants. I was going to just start naming off animals.
Go for it. Yeah.
But there's just a ton of it.
Yeah.
A ton of it everywhere.
Snakes everywhere.
Yes. on planes. But we're doing a great job of kind of getting rid of it, thinning the herd of life, right? Humans are.
Right. Yeah. We're getting rid of a lot of the higher order animals for sure.
Mm-hmm.
There are more, tigers in captivity, I think, in Texas than there are in the wild.
Great.
Or in the United States. Which may be a podcast for a different day, but if there are so many different types of life that we know of, and the most common life is still debatably life on our planet, then the question is, why haven't we found anything else?
Well, it's a very simple answer. The universe is huge. Yeah, well, it's true.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, come on. The universe is all, if we're going to talk about definitions, the universe is every single, just all of the matter, all of the energy, all of it.
Yeah.
That exists. That is the universe.
That's a lot of stuff.
And, you know, if you think about just the pale blue dot, that image, or, you know, some of the things that Carl Sagan talked about,
right,
just how insignificant our tiny little planet is, and even how small our sun is in comparison to other stars, you just realize that we have this massive amount of life just on this tiny little speck of dust. You just know that there has to be something else out there somewhere.
You know, I think of it sometimes where, have you ever seen an animal in a weird place, like you're in a grocery store and you see a bird and you think, how'd that bird get here?
I've seen a little blue-tailed lizard at a gym one time. Uh-huh. And I was just going, what? What are you doing in here?
Yeah.
Getting a workout or something.
And trying to take them outside or somewhere where they belong. I wonder, the comparison of the pale blue dot makes me think of that. But if we were to talk numbers about the size of the known universe, it's so big that we do not have the technology to figure out how big it is, right?
Yeah, so, we can read it to a certain extent, but that's just as far as our technology has gotten us yet.
Right, yeah, we can see the part that we can detect extends in all directions for about 10 billion light years. Based on these observations, experts believe the universe is between 10 and maybe 20 billion years old. And the Earth is relatively a rookie in the game, being only 4.5 billion years old.
Yeah. And life didn't originate on Earth for a long time after it was created.
Right. Yeah. We're still figuring that part out too. So we've got these people called cosmologists, study cosmology, the study of just the whole universe, which sounds like a pretty ambitious degree, right? And, according to some of these folks, the universe has no limits in space or time. Galaxies seem to be traveling away from Earth and each other at ever increasing speeds, providing the basis for the concept that the entire universe, as well as the part we know about, is just expanding, just going bigger and bigger.
It just goes out.
Yep. And, you know, that's really cool. It's a little bit of a lonely place to think about, right? But,
and by the way, if you want to know more about this kind of stuff, cosmology, I highly recommend you check out Cosmos if you're not already watching it on National Geographic and Fox.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned Cosmos. Neil deGrasse Tyson had another show before that that was also good.
Nova.
And you and I are also pretty big fans of various science shows. And these science shows, inevitably, if they touch on space, they have to tackle some of the big questions, which are, first, there's this huge paradox, right? Life on Earth is everywhere. Some forms of life that maybe don't even seem like good ideas are still around. And then we have the universe, the biggest empty room in reality. Now, of course, it's not empty, right?
Just mostly.
We know there has to be something. So it appears that the problem with finding alien life, which we've talked about in this podcast before, is that the gap in space isn't even as worrisome as the gap in time, right?
Absolutely. And as we know, they are interconnected. So people have kind of pondered some of these things even before they really understood what the universe was, what it was made of, what the galaxies were, you know, even what rotated, what orbited around what. People have been looking up and thinking, oh man, what the heck is going on up there? And, you know, we come up with stories about the heavens and beings that live up in those stars.
Sure, yeah.
And so there's been this constant search, at least internally,
right,
for what the heck is going on up there. And in 1959, this thing called SETI came around, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And in that year, 1959, Cornell physicist Giuseppe Cocconi, Cocconi, and Philip Morrison, they published this article in Nature, which is, isn't that a journal? And they pointed out that the potential for using microwave radio, they could use that to communicate or at least send signals outward, and then also possibly receive signals that were coming in towards Earth.
Right, and this was a very interesting finding. Before we go a little bit further, let me go ahead and establish some of the other things here. There's the thing called the Fermi paradox we need to know about.
Okay.
If life exists, why haven't we found it? You and I talked about that with the time and space. And then there's something else we'll explore called the Drake Equation.
Yes.
And let's introduce that guy now. Turns out in the 60s, he is a young radio astronomer, which was a thing even back then. He had come to the same idea about microwave radio, and he conducted the first microwave radio search for signals from other solar systems in 1960, in spring, I believe. So here's what he did. For 2 months, he aimed a antenna in West Virginia in the direction of two nearby stars that he thought were kind of like our sun. He tuned his receiver to what he called the magic frequency, which we talked about in our video series, right, Matt? So what's the magic frequency?
Well, it is the 21 centimeter line, or the 1,420 megahertz. Mm-hmm. That's what you're, that's the signal.
Yeah. That's the frequency of the signal. Yeah. It's a neutral hydrogen. And this turns out to be a spot on the radio dial that Cosoni or Cocconi and Morrison also believed had significance. Drake's 2 months searching the skies for life, did garner a response and got some interest, but not from the intelligent life he was looking for. Yeah. Instead of aliens,
it was terrestrial. It came from the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1960s, the Soviet Union pretty much held sway over the SETI project. And, it would adopt all these bold strategies. And rather than searching nearby stars, the Soviets, they just basically set up these almost omnidirectional antenna, and they would observe just these wide swaths of the sky, and they would just kind of count on the existence of at least a few advanced civilizations somewhere out there in this, you know, the scope that they're looking through. And they just assume that one or more of them would be radiating some kind of transmission power from their planet or from whatever it is that they inhabit.
Yeah, and you know, probably be communist too, right? That was the, if we're making assumptions.
Yeah, they sort would of be like hive mindish.
Yeah, sort of like the Soviet search for Shambhala when they said, well, clearly this mystery religion and city is real. They're going to be communists. So what I hope is coming out here in this part of the show is that SETI itself, while there is a SETI Institute, while there are SETI projects, there's it's much less centralized than you might think. SETI is just an acronym.
It's a pursuit.
Right, that search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So different groups, some of which may be familiar, some of which may be unfamiliar, have messed with it. And there's a wide swath, to use your word, of opinions about this. So NASA even got involved, right?
Oh, yeah. So kind of the beginning of the 1970s, the Ames Research Center, that's in Mountain View, California, by the way, they began to kind of consider the technology required for a true search that would be effective enough, you know, to prove this stuff. So a team of outside experts under the direction of this guy, Bernard Oliver,
from Hewlett-Packard, right?
That's correct. He made this study for NASA, which was known as Project Cyclops. You've probably heard of that before if you're a fan of this show. And the Cyclops report, it basically gave an analysis of SETI science and kind of the tech issues that they were dealing with at the time. It's really the foundation on which pretty much all of the subsequent work from SETI is based upon.
Yeah, and it was some pretty good news, too, because during this time, more and more people began to believe, hey, this, we might have the science.
There's something to it.
To actually, get cooking with gas here, or excuse me, microwave radio. And, so the Ames Research Center had some SETI programs, and so did JPL in Pasadena, and they started working together to do targeted searches, which is opposite of what the USSR was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, Congress terminated the funding. So we're wasting money. We're throwing real dollars at imaginary beings, essentially.
Or yeah.
We can't find them. So people began getting disappointed in SETI. But SETI continues today, and we'll tell you how the search for intelligent life is going along with allegations of cover-ups, after a word from our sponsor.
Hello, friend. Are you feeling cooped up?
Well, yeah, of course.
Do you work too much?
Sure, doesn't everybody?
No.
Oh.
So, what if I gave you the opportunity to take a vacation, a long, relaxing vacation?
Oh, yeah, I guess, but who can afford a vacation nowadays? I can only go to those boring places, like, you know, a day trip an hour away, or just kind of sit in my bathroom and put a different picture on the wall and pretend I'm somewhere else.
We know how you feel, friend. That's why we're offering you this rare opportunity to travel to space.
To space? Where'd you go? Come back.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I dropped my pen. So, friend, with Space Station 1, we can send you as far out into space as you'd like.
Whoa.
You can even bring your dog.
Oh, what?
Yes.
Did you hear that, boy? We love space, but how can we afford to go? I mean, we're just regular people. We're not millionaires or billionaires or astronauts.
Well, here's the thing. With Space Station 1, we're offering discounted one-way trips to space for you, up to two loved ones, and two pets.
Wait, did you say one-way trips?
Yes, friend. You'll never have to worry again about your tiresome job or those boring TV shows that get recycled and recycled. There are no ads on Space Station 1. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and you're sure this has nothing to do with my history of political activism?
Actually, if you have a history of any kind of political activism, your first Space Station 1 Space Station is on the house.
What? Sign me up. Did you hear that, boy? We're going to space.
Sir? Did you want to go? Sir?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, totally. Sign me up.
Okay, all right.
I was
cool.
Just excited.
No, it's fine. I just wanted to make sure because we've got all the paperwork.
Space Station 1 is in no way responsible for costs incurred on Earth while you are in space. We bear no responsibility for depressurization, bone loss, muscle mass loss, space fatness, synapse, yips, tuberculosis, space cabin fever, xenobiology, astronaut attacks, astronaut-on-astronaut violence, meteor showers, meteor collisions, space eye, toe jam, gravity lung, boredom, or ennui. By agreeing to the terms of Station 1's permanent one-way trip vacation into deep space, you voluntarily and irrevocably relinquish your rights to any terrestrial property, children, inventions, patents, or legal personhood.
Space Station 1 is brought to you by Illumination Global Unlimited.
Okay, and we're back. Now, just so we go back in here to set up a quick laundry list, Matt, I was thinking we could each read off some projects of SETI.
Oh, great. There are a ton of these.
Okay.
I'm going to start with Project OSMA.
Oh, that's the very first one, right?
Yep. It's the first SETI search. It was conducted by astronomer Frank Drake that we talked about, and that was in 1960.
Then there's the Ohio State Big Ear SETI project launched in 73, and that is the one that we mentioned in the video. That's where we got the wow signal, which is either a natural phenomenon that we have never heard of before or since and still can't explain, or somehow is a signal from intelligent life.
Either way, it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the Big Ear?
Oh, it was shut down in 1997.
For a golf course.
For a golf course, of course.
Okay, so then you've got Project Serendip that you may have heard of as well. That was launched by the University of California at Berkeley, and that was in 1979.
Yeah, NASA also had the HRMS, High Resolution Microwave Survey, in 1982, and discontinued in 93 when Congress cut the funding.
Now you've got Project META. This one's really cool. This was the Mega Channel Extraterrestrial Array, and it was launched at Harvard University in 1985, and it was meant to search 8.4 million 0.5 hertz channels. And so really low frequency.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the Columbus Optical SETI, COSETI. That's an earlier one. It's 1990s, and it is searching for laser signals.
Then you got Project Beta, another familiar one possibly. The Billion Channel Extraterrestrial Array that was also launched at Harvard University in 1995 and, again, searching billions of channels.
And then there's Project Phoenix, which SETI Institute launched to continue the work of NASA.
Project Argus, which launched in 96 And this was SETI League's All-Sky Survey Project.
So they're looking everywhere.
Yep.
That's sort of like shaking the entire haystack and hoping to prick yourself on a needle. Well, maybe that's unfair.
Maybe.
Then there's the Southern Serendip, and then there's the one of the most exciting ones for anybody who feels like personally lending a hand to the search for intelligent life.
SETI at home. Now, this is the... It came out in 1999, I think. I think that's around the time that I signed up for it. And it was essentially literally a program that ran kind of behind the scenes on your computer, and it just crunched data, basically. It was analyzing data. Did you ever do that?
Yeah, I did it for a short time.
I even did it here at How Stuff Works on my computer when I would go home.
I remember that.
Overnight, it would be running SETI at home.
Mm-hmm. So maybe this could be your way or our way to pitch in and find intelligent life. But now, Noel, please, could I get some conspiracy music? Perfect. Thank you. The reason we're asking for this music, of course, is because now it's time to talk about whether there could be a cover-up, because Matt, you'll remember when we did our video, a lot of you guys were commenting on YouTube about how SETI has a secrecy clause.
Yes, it does.
Publicly disclose things, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that, Matt?
So yeah, you got to think about, let's just think about the pursuit of science. Science, when you're conducting a study, you know, and then you have some findings that you really want someone to know about, or you want the world to know about, for, you know, fame, fortune, and the advancement of science, you generally make your work known. You release it. You get it. You send it to journals to get it peer reviewed.
Right.
And that's on a general wide level. But at the localized level, in the study that's occurring, the one study that a group of scientists is doing somewhere, that's usually kept pretty private.
Okay.
Because you don't want other scientists to know exactly what it is that you're looking at, because, again, you're searching for, I use the phrase fame and fortune, but...
You don't want to get scooped.
Exactly. So that's just between scientists, right, trying to keep things secretive. Right. But there's another group that's even more tenuous, has a more tenuous relationship with the individual scientist.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah.
The, journalist, right? The media. Yeah, that does make sense, because if you read, news, whether on the internet, whether through a newspaper or, you know, on your local television, you realize over time that the media and journalists have a tendency to grab something, sensationalize it, and run with it. So if somebody publishes a study that says we found a certain type of amino acid when combined in this certain situation will do, you know, action X, then people may well come out with amino acid has intelligence solving puzzles, you know.
Exactly. Well, and that's why the press releases are so important for places like NASA, CDC, things like that. Or if you actually have a, you know, every once in a while you'll hear that NASA is going to make an announcement, or the CDC will make an announcement, and they have a very public, hey, and there's usually a PR person there trying to give out the message. Now that works both ways in my mind, Ben. So it's not only is it trying to make clear what the information is, but it's
trying to manage it.
It's managing it. Exactly. It's spinning it.
Yeah. I see. That's the thing. 'Cause you and I talked about this too. Like, we know that, you know, that this guy, wrote a book called The Eerie Silence, Are We Alone in the Universe? Professor Paul Davies. He was the chair of, the SETI Post-Detection Science and Technology Task Group for a while. And he said that the group themselves grappled with the need for public disclosure, but they ultimately decided to keep it behind closed doors kind of decisions, because they were worried that if information leaked out prematurely, they might be in, for lack of a better phrase, a boy who cried wolf situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when the WOW signal came out, there was a huge media just outpouring of, whoa, and speculation, just saying, what the heck was this thing? Is it aliens? Oh my God, we know now. We now know that we're not alone in the universe because of the WOW signal.
Right. Yeah. And,
which may be true, but it's not, it's not a proven thing, right?
Right. Yeah. We look at that a little bit in our video series. Again, if you haven't checked it out, do check it out. Cause we learned some really cool stuff in there. Especially there's that one quote that, Jerry Emmons says where he,
at the very beginning of the video.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to ruin it for you, but
yeah, check it out.
Check it out. So we also, I figured it was best for us to go straight to the source when we were talking about some of the conspiratorial stuff, whether there has been evidence that has been suppressed. So from SETI's, frequently asked questions, they tackle a lot of this stuff. One question is, has SETI, found life or evidence of life on other planets? The answer is no. Scientists have found no clear indications of life past or present beyond the Earth. There have been tantalizing suggestions that the Viking mission might have detected evidence of microbial life on Mars, or that there are fossil microbes in some Mars rocks, but they haven't been verified yet. Now, if you believe that there is an extraterrestrial contact with Earth already, then of course, It's easy to see how SETI could seem like smoke and mirrors. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? But, I have to say it's kind of difficult to believe that if there were extraterrestrials on the planet, it's difficult to believe how that could remain a secret.
Agreed.
Unless now we're at one of my favorite parts of the episode too, Matt, which is where I ask you, you ask me about this sort of stuff. I want to go ahead and jump into this right away. We talked earlier about the origin of life on Earth, mm-hmm. right? Still kind of wishy-washy. We're still not sure exactly how it happened. But there's that great theory with that horrible name, which we've already mentioned on our podcast.
Panspermia?
Yeah, which would mean that if it were true, it would mean that we were the alien life form. Right.
That life. Yeah. Life was the alien life form.
Right. That, to go with our virus analogy, that if you picture Earth as just a single celled organism, right, with everything that a virus needs to survive, then somehow on a meteor, we washed out into Earth and then just started replicating. And now we're teeming over, you know, infesting the host.
Organic. Life. Wow. That's intense, man. For me, that's a hugely compelling argument for how life came about. I know it's a little tough because you have to assume that life existed somewhere else for it to get here.
It's kind of kicking the can down the road, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just, exactly.
So it's not exactly answering our stuff, but, it all goes back to the idea of life as we know it, based on DNA, based on RNA. What else could be out there? Could there be some other thing that doesn't use any of that? You know,
well, it's a possibility. And that's the great thing about SETI. We've allowed ourselves to think differently mm-hmm. through this search. And I think, man, Ben, I gotta tell you, I think we're gonna find some really soon with the new, telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to at least find the trace of life. It's going to be microbial. It's going to be tiny, microorganisms, but it's going to be there.
There's another fascinating idea that I heard, a conspiratorial idea, which was that, for ideological or religious reasons, people in government and in the executive levels of different scientific institutes were cooperating to destroy evidence of alien life, like, you know, microbial stuff, mm-hmm. So that it wouldn't shake the foundations of world religions. You know, I heard it sometimes for Christianity, primarily for Christianity. It was a very interesting theory. I didn't find too much to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I read specifically was citing the methodology of testing soil for life, or testing dirt on Mars or the moon. There's a method that the rovers use to heat up the, we talked about this, right?
Yeah, we did in the Life on Mars, I think.
Yeah, they heat up the sample and incinerate it, essentially, and then analyze the gases.
Mm-hmm.
So
if there was something in there, it would show up in the different gases, right? If it was carbon-based.
Yeah.
But what
if
it's not carbon-based? Then,
Who knows? There are a couple of different ideas with that. That was an interesting theory to me, and I would love to learn if there were, you know, is it possible that some sort of alien craft or alien culture interacted with Earth at some point in history? It's possible. It's difficult to see how it could be plausible given the time and distance involved without going into some sort of, extra dimensional idea, right?
Yeah. I want to believe that stuff. You know that.
Yeah.
Everybody listening knows I want to believe.
Absolutely. Fox Mulder over here.
I hope you do too. I think that's important. It's the inspiration and the imagination that keeps us going.
Absolutely. First off, if we didn't want to figure out what's going on, if we didn't want to believe things, then, there would have been no progress as a species.
Yeah. Well, why would you even look into it?
And also, clearly, the most implausible thing at all in this entire conversation, the most unreasonable, impossible thing is that there would not be other intelligent life somewhere in the universe. Given that there is an infinite size, that's the most ridiculous thing. That is literally the most ridiculous thing to think.
Thank you, Dr. Drake.
Yeah. Thank you for the Drake equation. God, it's time for us to go, and we didn't even get to the shadow biosphere, which I think we should talk about in the future.
We will.
All right.
We have to. But before we get out of here, really quickly, I just want to read this piece of listener mail. This comes from Charles B. He says, hello. I saw the video about aliens in Dulce, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Sorry,
my
guys.
Fault, guys. Blame it on me. It was my fault.
Blame it on both of us.
He says, I'm from New Mexico, and I'm a lifelong resident. Ever since I was in grade school, Dulce has always been associated with aliens like Roswell, New Mexico is. And he says, growing up and now in adulthood, the people in New Mexico, they have an inside joke for Dulce, and that is Dulce is where the government kept all their aliens.
Huh.
All towns in northern New Mexico, even Dulce, are very rural, and the mass majority of these towns have only one high school. That kind of gives you an idea of how small they might be. He also says that many people in the northern part of New Mexico still speak Spanish and are very close to one another. People and their families don't stay very far away from their homes and communities in northern New Mexico. In a town like Dulce, it's very common to find two or three generations of intermediate and extended families living together and in small communities. So odds are finding people that may have personal insight on this alien matter might not be too difficult.
Hmm.
In the video, you spoke about the alleged security guard Thomas Costello and how there might be confusion about the spelling of his name, either COS or CAS. And what Charles here suggests is that it may actually be Castillo,
mm-hmm.
like a Spanish version
sure.
of it.
Yeah.
And he also says later on that it might not be Thomas, it might be Tomas.
Mm-hmm.
However, I kind of looked into it and found out that it is actually, the alleged person is Thomas Edwin Costello.
Ah, okay.
So I just wanted to let you know, by the way, thank you, Charles, for writing in. Let us know.
That's
interesting insight.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a little more digging and we found out that it is Thomas Edwin Costello.
And we are going to keep digging. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we'd like to hear what we should cover in upcoming episodes. There are a couple ways to find us. We're all over the internet. Check out Matt and I on Twitter. See us on Facebook, where we post a lot of stuff that we never get to do shows on,
mm-hmm.
right? I was really excited about that blood thing. I don't know if we'll
yeah.
get to it. And follow our website, stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com. If you want to get past the social media rigmarole and write to us, then we love hearing your stories. We are going to do an episode with that ghost story. Well, you persuaded us. We had so many people write in and say, tell us it's an amazing story and then not cover it.
It's inevitable now.
So that is on the way, we promise. In the meantime, let us know your stories. All of our best ideas and all of our best stories come from our listeners, so we want to hear from you. Our email address is
conspiracy@discovery.com.
For more on this topic and other unexplained phenomena, visit testtube.com/conspiracy stuff. You can also get in touch on Twitter at the handle @conspiracy stuff.